Hello again and welcome to another College of Optometrists podcast with me, Martin Cordner, Head of Research at the College.
And me, Daniel Hardman-McCartney, Clinical Advisor at the College.
Today we have the first instalment of what I am calling Daniel's bite-sized double album, as we bring you the first of two interviews that Daniel recorded at the College's bite-sized conference in October. But before we get to that, Daniel, how are you?
Yeah, good. Lots going on.
So we record just slightly after Bonfire Night.
Yep.
Did you have any exciting, tragic events? Did anything happen?
I'm very pleased to report there were no events personally and no events in practice. So no patients coming in with sparklers, traumatic injuries. Although I did spot, actually, a firework that was called the Eye Popper.
Right. The Eye Popper. And what exactly does that involve?
I don't know. It was some kind of rocket type thing called an eye popper.
Right. I'm guessing it's not literal.
I hope not.
Let's hope not. Have you ever had anything like that?
Yeah, no. In practice, optometrists do get people coming in with injury, mainly smoke in their eyes.
Right.
I don't know. I've had that in practice. Okay. Following day, smoke irritation. I think most trauma goes straight to A&E.
Yes.
But it's not unheard of.
Blimey. And also, we just yesterday, in fact, you received your fellowship by portfolio.
Very exciting day.
Congratulations. How was that, Daniel?
It was immense. It's a really important day of the optometry calendar, and it was really humbling to be on stage with so many other people who were receiving life fellowships. So the really big one, David Elliott, editor of OPO, Catherine Saunders for her work and publications, Wendy Newsome, community practitioner who spent her whole career trying to build bridges between hospital optometry and community optometry, and Cindy Tromans, our ex-president of the College. To name but a few, there were more.
Yes, there were plenty, certainly. Whenever I hear about the fellowship by portfolio, I imagine like an actor's portfolio with like a range. here's Daniel angry, here's Daniel sad, here's Daniel thoughtful. It's like you have to give him fellowship. Look at his range.
Happy face, sad face,
exactly,
optometrist.
Yeah. Look at him looking down a microscope. Look, he can do the lot.
That's right. Indeed. We should suggest
so
that.
So that's why you got it, basically.
That's right. My happy face, sad face portfolio.
Excellent. So the interview we're going to hear today is with Simon
Franovich.
Thank you very much. He is an optometrist, orthoptist, working in private optometric practice and in the hospital eye service, both as an optometrist and orthoptist. He delivers lectures and workshops to qualified and pre-registration optometrists in a wide variety of binocular vision subject areas.
So I spoke to Simon really about the difference between orthoptics and optometry, and that's other than the spelling, how the two approaches work, differences in prescribing prisms, and also the value of hands-on learning and shared learning as well.
So, without further ado, here's side one of Daniel's White Album.
We're in Milton Keynes. It's bite-sized today. Thank you very much for joining us. We're joined by Simon Franovich. Travelled up from Somerset yesterday.
I did indeed. It's a long way. Longer than you think.
And so, first of all, tell us about yourself. How did you get to this point in your career?
Thank you, Daniel. I started out life as an orthoptist, and I did my training at Liverpool University. It was a subject that I knew very little about, but it seemed the kind of thing that would inspire me. I wanted something medical. I wanted something that you had to use your brain. You had to deal with every patient slightly differently. And that's very much how I found orthoptics. It was a detective exercise. So you were presented with a set of symptoms. You had to work out your diagnosis by doing a series of tests. And I found it extremely fulfilling. I worked in that field for 2 years in Reading at the Royal Berkshire Hospital, and then realised there was so much about the job that I enjoyed, but I needed a bit more. I needed more horizons, if you like. So I returned to City University and studied optometry, and then graduated and worked with Leighton's Opticians in Basingstoke, and that's where I earned my spurs. And then a couple of years after that, I got the opportunity to have a partnership in independent practice in Somerset, and that's where I spend my time now. For nearly 15 years, I've been a director of two independent practices, one in Yeovil and one in Chard, and I am extremely fulfilled in my work. There is no such thing as a normal, boring day.
How does optometry compare to orthoptics, the course?
Very, very different indeed. Very different. I think with orthoptics, you primarily were learning about the eye movement systems, and there were many other allied elements to it, such as psychology, sociology, and such like. Whereas in optometry, there was a lot more eyes and every aspect of the eyes and physiology, anatomy, etc. So certainly the courses that I went on, there was a lot more eye stuff in optometry than there was in orthoptics. But what has been very, very useful is the way the two courses complement each other. And certainly binocular vision is taught very, very differently in orthoptics than it is in optometry. And it's I feel privileged to have both viewpoints, I suppose.
So with education changing in a few years' time, do you think aspects of orthoptics, like the cytology that you mentioned, would be beneficial for optometrists to cover?
Again, there's many things about my day job where it's not what you say, it's how you say it, and they're skills that I didn't learn in my optometry degree. They're very much things I learned in my orthoptics degree. So I can see a lot of sense in there being a core set of skills that both professions learn. And then there's almost divergence after a couple of years of core training. You can sort of head either left or right. I could see that that would be maybe a more sensible way of doing it.
What about learning with other healthcare professionals? Optometry is quite isolated, isn't it? Mm. Not on your own.
Certainly in the city, there was very, very little that we ever did with anyone else. Whereas in orthoptics, we used to do our anatomy with dentists, doctors, radiographers, occupational therapists, physios. And that was extremely handy. I remember one session that we had where all the professions got together with a whiteboard. And we said, well, what do you each think the other one does? And it was very telling that we didn't have a clue what a physiotherapist did or what an occupational therapist did. And that was very, very helpful for, again, my future work.
And when you're in practice, do you, in your mind, are you putting on an orthoptist hat or an optometrist hat, or have the two yous merged together?
Oh, my goodness
me.
It's wonderful that you use that exact phrase, because that's how I put it to my patients. And I will say to them, I've just now put my orthoptic hat on to do these particular tests or to explain this to you. I think it's primarily my optometric hat in private practice that I would use. There's no doubt about it. But you can't help but think, hang on a minute, you just mentioned that you get a little bit of eye strain or these images are moving up and down a little bit. Let's put my orthoptic hat on for a second. Let's investigate that further and then find that tiny vertical deviation that no one had ever spotted before, or some other sort of obscure orthoptic problem that had just been overlooked. So, yeah, the two very much complement each other.
And have you been able to grow your practice specifically around orthoptics and BV to
utilise that? Not actively. When you come from orthoptics, you're very much, you have the NHS, everything's free at the point of need, and it almost mentally acts as a barrier to say, I can't charge people for these services, when if I were more business-minded, I probably would. But it has grown almost accidentally by being the person that can fix the problems that no one else has fixed, which sounds remarkably arrogant, I know, but in a lot of cases that can be what's happening. Then word spreads that you've been able to fix that issue and other people come to you and your business develops from there. It's organic growth rather than going out there to promote what we do.
And how do you manage the time aspect of things? So for me, I'm always aware that a lot of BV tests are quite time consuming, and obviously there's constraints in practice with time, the NHS fee and
I'm a terrible businessman probably, because I give people the time that they need, and when it's your own business, I take that view that I'm happy with them to come back, and if I need to add a little bit more on, then I do that. There are times that it is appropriate to charge people extra for my time and my services, and I do that where it falls outside of the remit of what we normally should do, but I'm sure many of my professional colleagues would shoot me down for doing the way I do it.
But you have a very successful business as a result.
I'd like to think so, yes, it is.
That kit, because you go into an orthoptic department in a hospital and it's like this wonderful lab of exciting Victorian type gadgets and equipment.
Yep.
So do you have a lot of that kit in your practice?
I well remember one of my lecturers from my orthoptics degree who said that you could basically do orthoptics on the back seat of a bus, and you just need a core set of equipment to do 90% of the work. You need a fixation target, an occluder, pen torch, and a set of prism bars. And I think with those things, you could do the vast majority of binocular vision testing. If you want to take things further and do a Lee's screen or a Hess chart, or you wanted to look at a synoptophore and those kind of things, they're kind of more specialist gadgets. But a lot of it is actually, it's just fairly basic bits of equipment. It's what you do with the information that's where the skill comes.
So really, it's not a barrier to all optometrists, really?
I cannot see what piece of equipment any optometrist would lack in their trial case. We've all got prisms in our trial cases. They may not be stuck together, but they're there. And if you haven't got a 20 darter prism, you've got a 12 and an 8, you can stick the two together and you can add up to 20. So you don't need anything special. It's all there. It's just having the confidence to realise you've got the bits and you can do it.
So if an orthoptist could say or tell or give an optometrist one bit of advice that would change their world, what would that be?
That's a very good question. Piece of advice I would give to anyone who will listen is, you know this stuff. It's not difficult. Just think. It's just take a step back. Think of what the eye muscles do. We all learn about the functions of the extraocular muscles. So whenever you're doing your ocular motility testing, just picture which muscle you're testing in which direction. And you'll then think, well, this eye is not getting up quite high enough, so that must be an underaction of the superior rectus muscle. Then you can work out from that what prisms you might need to give them, what the double vision the patient might be experiencing, etc. So it's just visualise your ocular motility, I think, that's got to be a really fundamental thing that people just simply don't do. You go through the motions without thinking why you're doing it.
So it's going beyond that parrot fashion.
Yeah, just thinking, oh yeah, just I've done what I need to do. Yeah, that's fine. And because people go through that process to put a tick in a box to say motility is full.
Yep.
But what if it isn't full? And then people stop and panic and think, I don't know what to do. If you thought about the muscles that you were working, you would then be able to work out which was defective, and it all falls from that. That's what I talk about in my lecture and my workshops today, is just trying to help people visualize these things. There's some very, very simple diagrams that I've created for people that I encourage them just to put behind their patient on the wall. So whenever you're doing your motility, you can see which muscles you're working with, and everything comes from that.
So let's talk about that. So you're really busy today. You're doing 3 sessions for us.
Absolutely. Yes, you're getting your money's worth.
So a lecture and 2 practical sessions.
That's right.
So tell us about the lecture. What kind of things are you going to be covering?
Yeah, certainly.
Don't give us the whole lecture.
Of course not. No. I'm not going to give it. There's no spoilers. But everything today that I'm doing is unashamedly back to basics. I think I even call the workshop a back to basics look at binocular vision, because we know this stuff. Everybody has been taught this stuff. As I said earlier, the way it's taught in optometry, I think it was certainly the way it was taught to me as an optometrist, is very different from how it was taught to me as an orthoptist. And I think the orthoptic way of having it taught seems to be much more logical, again, for me. So it's a way of translating the way it might have been taught in one discipline to the way it's been taught in another discipline, and hopefully just breaking down some barriers. It's very satisfying seeing the penny drop when you can explain something to people. So even in a big lecture theatre, you can still see I get it now. So there are videos that I've put together to show things like Herring's Law, why Herring's Law is important, muscle sequelae, all the things that we've learnt about that we just shudder and think, oh my gosh, I don't understand it. So it's just making people leave having understood why we do ocular motility and what to look for.
So your sessions are really popular. That's why we're doing 3 of them today. Mm-hmm. And so you'd say the main barriers why optometrists are so nervous about BV are practice or exposure in their training?
I would have to say it's just understanding, confidence in your knowledge. Because like a lot of things, we learn how glaucoma works. We learn how cataracts work. We learn how the binocular vision system works. We're taught it in the same way. But if you're not looking for those things in every patient, you're not thinking about it in every patient, you naturally become rusty. And then when you do encounter somebody who's got a sudden onset fourth nerve palsy, you're thinking, well, what on earth am I supposed to do here? If you thought about motility every time you did it and thought what the muscles were that you were testing, I just think it prepares you better for the exceptional cases, the things that sometimes catch people off guard.
So for listeners today who aren't able to come to your lecture or your workshops, you'd say a way that they could practice would be to really almost pretend that they might be experiencing a nerve palsy or something and to go through the process of that once or twice a week.
Every time you test motility, and as an orthoptist, I would have to say, well, why aren't you testing motility on every patient that you're seeing? If they've got 2 eyes, you should be looking for a motility defect. But every time you do it, if you're going up to the right, say to yourself, I'm testing the right superior rectus and the left inferior oblique, and I'm looking down to the right. And just think about which muscles that you're testing. And as I've said, there is a resource that I've prepared and I'm sure the college can share, which has all of that information on it that you can laminate, stick on the wall behind your patient. And there's no reason you can't then get better at doing it every single time.
So in terms of BV practice, would you say you find it more rewarding in paediatric practice or adult practice, or are there any aspects of it that particularly appeal to you?
I think orthoptics is quite a unique profession, in that there are, if you look at the cohort of patients that visit an orthoptic department, there's a big spike between the ages of 2 and 7 and a massive spike over 70, and there's very little in between. So the kind of patients that you're seeing, they tend to fit into the two categories. They're either pediatric, esotropia, nexotropia, straightforward amblyopia type management. And then the adults are those who present with more complex binocular vision disorders, diplopia, asthenopia. So they are rewarding in different ways. To be the person who's first found somebody to be plus five right and left and stop them from getting amblyopia is amazingly satisfying. To be the person that they come to every year and remember Simon the eye man and have a great time when they have their eyes tested, that's very, very fulfilling. As is being the person to find the tiny half diopter prism that has caused this person real difficulty driving for the last 20 years. So they are fulfilling in different ways.
Talk prisms. So a lot of optometrists are very nervous about prescribing prisms.
Yeah.
What would be your tips?
Just get it right. Don't give too many, don't give too few. That sounds very flippant.
So what prisms? About small prisms? So when I started in practice, a lot of people would prescribe kind of like quarter and half prism doctors, various different things. And some practitioners were like, no, that's changed their life. It's really important. And then I had other practitioners saying, well, why on earth are you doing that? It's either there or it isn't.
We could have another entire podcast just on that subject.
Maybe we should.
maybe we should. I think my personal feeling about prisms, and this is how I choose to do it, is I would always test whether the patient experiences a difference. So particularly in an adult, I keep talking about vertical deviations. If one of the things that I will talk about today is fusion ranges, and we all should have in our mind what fusion ranges are, so how much you can converge and diverge your eyes. And there is a very broad range of convergence and divergence, but a very, very small range of vertical fusion. So if somebody has a one diopter exophoria, 9 times out of 10 they can correct that well themselves. If they have a one diopter vertical phoria, that can really mess things up because you're eating into maybe a third or a quarter of their entire fusional reserves. So it's giving somebody a prism that is relevant to them. If you put in a one diopter prism for someone in that latter case, you can see it on their face. You can see that, oh, you found it. That's what I've needed all my life. And when you get that effect, you give that prism. If you don't get that effect, then I would be inclined not to give that prism because it may be erroneous. Mm-hmm. So I wish there were a one strap line I could say, Simon says this about prisms. Unfortunately, it is down to the individual case. But when people never give prisms or give prisms to everybody, I think they're the outliers. It's about the bit in the middle.
What about fixation disparity? Because sometimes when I mention that to orthoptists, colleagues, their eyes roll as if it doesn't exist.
Yep.
Are there differences in thoughts?
Unbelievable differences. And this is something I fail to understand because as an orthoptist, any textbook that I've ever had about orthoptics doesn't even mention fixation disparity, or if it does, it is a single line just saying this is a test that optometrists use. I don't know why it's that way, because in practice it is so incredibly useful, again, for finding those poorly controlled, very, very small deviations. In orthoptic practice, we used to achieve the same end by putting prisms in front of people's eyes and saying, tell me when it's most comfortable. Is it most comfortable with one or two? And I'm sure if you put up a fixation, put up a mallet unit at that point, you'd find that you'd align the markers when it was most comfortable. So that's something, if I could change the world of orthoptics and optometry, I'd love for there to be more of a crossover in fixation disparity. It's such a useful test. And I wish I'd had it as an orthoptist.
What about other tests? So non-BV tests, things like visual acuity, anything visual acuity, you know, how important is that? Does that really feed into BV?
Hugely so, and particularly in children. So the way I see it with young children, and in other talks that I give, I mention the sort of ticking time bomb you have with young children, that you have a patient who, or a parent who brings their child to you the age of 3, they're concerned they might have a binocular vision disorder. You've probably got about 4 minutes of that child's attention before there's meltdown. So you have to get as much information from as few tests as possible. And one of the most useful things that you can do is, when you're testing their vision, is just look to see, well, is the vision the same in each eye, or are they objecting to one eye being covered up more than the other eye? But you can even get that information from a cover test. If you can't test someone's vision, if you see that someone has very slow fixation on a cover test, they must have poor vision in that eye, otherwise they'd have good fixation. So you can actually get your vision measurement from a cover test. It's about thinking a bit more about broader about how the eyes work together.
What about about drugs? Do you ever have any reservations about doing encyclopedic refractions?
None whatsoever. I have a very, very low threshold for doing encyclopedic refractions. And I would encourage anybody to do the same, particularly in cases where you just can't get a good result, if the patient's not cooperative, if there's any concern at all about them having a binocular vision disorder or having a family history of it. Children are very, very good at over-accommodating, and you'll lose... I see this all the time in my hospital clinic, patients who've been refracted without cycloplegia who might be wearing plus one, plus 150, and you cycloplegia them and they're plus six, plus 650. They can accommodate through so much that you need to take control. So I would routinely do cycloplegic refractions.
Now, I know you're a busy man, so you've got to go off and prepare for your first lecture.
Thank you.
If I have just one more question for you. So, do you think it's important that there's events like this, you know, hands-on events where people come to, or do you think actually the future is online learning and doing everything from afar?
There's definitely a place for online learning, there's no doubt about it. But for me, there's no substitute whatsoever for being in a room with other people, seeing how other people do it, whether as the provider of that session, where you can see your professional colleagues who've had many, many more years' experience as an optometrist than you have, with not a very good technique for their motility, you can then take their hand, you can show them, look, if you move your hand all the way to the side, you can, do you now see that you're missing this underaction here? So that's, as a provider of sessions like that, is very useful. But it's also a great way of just watching how other people do it and reassuring yourself, I'm doing it okay, I'm doing a good job. And I think you can only get that from being in the same place as other optometrists.
Simon, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure.
I hope the session's going well.
Thank you.
I look forward to hearing from you again soon, perhaps another podcast on...
You know where to find me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you very much to Simon for his time and his many interesting thoughts about his experiences of the two disciplines. Also, I think his advice about prisms is also very much applied to Christmas presents. Don't give too many. Don't give too few. As ever, you can like, rate, subscribe, etc. wherever you heard this podcast. Please do if you liked it or indeed you rate it.
That's us from today. And thanks for listening, and we look forward to next time.